early peace talks between Russia and Ukraine didn't put a stop to Russia's ongoing invasion of its neighbor, and it's not clear when the two countries will hold more negotiations. Over the weekend, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky listed actions from Russia that would make him walk away from further peace talks, and Russia dismissed an offer to attend negotiations in the city of Mariupol. That comes as the UN Secretary General visited Moscow yesterday to discuss ways to end the war. Our next guest is an expert on peace talks and says there are a lot of obstacles that warring countries face before they even open up peace negotiations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how peace talks between two countries work, the roadblocks on the way to even opening up those communications? Do you feel hopeful when you see headlines about peace talks taking place, or does it ring hollow to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Oriana Schuyler-Mastro is a Center Fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University, where she specializes in Chinese military and security policy. She's a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and author of the book, very relevant, The Costs of Conversation, Obstacles to Peace Talks in Wartime. And by the way, she's coming to Wisconsin next week. She'll be in Madison on May 4th for the 2022 La Follette Forum through UW-Madison. The year's themes are American Power, Prosperity, and Democracy. It's free to the public. We've got a link for information at WPR.org/Central Time. Oriana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, as a layperson, Oriana, I may think, you know, if a country is involved in a war, why not sit down for peace negotiations? It doesn't really cost anything. But that's just the thing, you're right. Countries consider a lot of costs before they sit down to even start talking. What are some of those obstacles?
Well, I think first it's important to keep in mind that most people have a general idea that what happens in the battlefield can impact talks, right? So maybe you're in negotiations with the other side, and so you escalate to try to put pressure on them when you're negotiating. But what people don't realize is how you approach diplomacy can impact your war effort. And this is the primary obstacle that states face when they're trying to decide whether or not to talk. They're concerned that if they show a willingness to engage in good faith negotiations, that it will signal to all players that they don't think the war is going very well and that their capabilities are weaker than expected. You know, this is particularly problematic with Russia, that has performed worse than most analysts have predicted, and signals to their own troops that are fighting that might impact their morale if they think, oh, you know, why should I keep on fighting this war if my leaders already think it's a done deal? So there's a lot of reasons why leaders are reluctant to take those first steps to genuinely consider peace at the negotiating table.
And is there a reverse incentive to say, you know, if we have peace talks in a month instead of today, well, maybe we'll have taken or retaken key territory or won a key victory that in turn would strengthen our position at that negotiating table if we wait and go?
So part of the waiting is not necessarily that those things are independent. Like the way you put it is that maybe things get better on the battlefield, and so in a month you'd be in a better position to negotiate. What my research shows is actually delaying that negotiation could put you in that better position because it signals your resolve to prolong the conflict that could potentially get other players that would have gotten involved to say, oh, actually, you know, if I think this is going to end in 2 weeks, I'm happy to provide equipment, material to Ukraine or what have you. But if it looks like this is going on for months and months and months, then I'm out. So it actually, not only would they potentially be better off waiting, but just that signal of being willing to wait shows that they are resolved to continue fighting.
You mentioned sort of third parties there. It isn't necessarily just about the two combatant countries, in this case, Ukraine and Russia and their troops and their civilians. Who do you see each side looking over their shoulder at as they decide whether or not and then how to enter into negotiations?
Well, I think the most important outside player actually right now is China when it comes to mediation. Of course, the U.S. role in putting pressure on Russia and providing, you know, equipment to Ukraine is critical. But in terms of the negotiations, what my research has showed is that if you're concerned as a leader that a willingness to talk will make you look weak and have a negative impact on your actual warfighting effort, you need a sort of face-saving measure that comes from the outside. So if an outside power can either step in and provide you with a reward, a positive inducement, or step in and ensure that no one escalates in response to willingness to talk, et cetera, then those leaders are more likely to come to the table. And China, that has both a relationship with Russia and Ukraine, is in the perfect position to play that mediation role. So just like China reached out to the Soviet Union during the Korean War and said to the Soviets, can you try to get the United States and us to talk? We'll pretend that we're, you know, this wasn't our idea, just so we don't look weak in this. I think the Russians could do the same to reach out to their partner, China, and say, hey, China, can you come in and try to present this outside view of getting both sides to the negotiating table.
Is there sort of a PR incentive on the world stage to say, hey, look, I'm willing to come and negotiate and talk. I'm a reasonable party here, world, other countries. Is there any advantage gained by taking that position?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the issue is that when you're fighting a war, winning the war trumps all other consideration. So only in certain scenarios, international reputation really becomes important, especially if you're relying on outside forces and countries for wartime support. But what states tend to do in that scenario, instead of really being willing to talk, is they articulate a willingness to talk if certain maximalist conditions are met, right? Conditions that no side would actually meet, but you might say something like, okay, Ukraine, I'm willing to talk if you know, as a precondition to those talks, agree that Donbas is a part of Russia. So Russia could do something like that to try to demonstrate, oh, but we're willing to negotiate. But with those types of conditions in place, states actually very rarely get to the table when those are still in place. So states do that, but they do it in a bit more sneaky way than just a willingness to talk.
We're talking to Oriana Schuyler-Mastro from Stanford University right now. She's author of the book, The Costs of Conversation. We're looking at what stops countries from holding peace talks while they're at war. You can join in if you'd like. If you have questions or thoughts, maybe a historical example you'd like to bring up, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on a peaceful resolution to the Russian invasion of Ukraine and how to get there? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Oriana Schuyler-Mastro is with us, author of the book, The Costs of Conversation, Obstacles to Peace Talks During Wartime. Oriana, some of what you just laid out there, especially the fear of looking weak if you even show up at a peace negotiation while you're at war, I mean, it makes it sound like it's almost impossible to start those negotiations. How historically has that incentive been overcome?
Well, when you say it sounds almost impossible, this is why in 85% of wars over the past 25 years, no negotiations have taken place in the early stages of conflict. And in many cases, people see negotiations as a precursor to the end of the war. Now in modern times, about 80% of our wars actually end by negotiated settlement. But getting to the table is just the first step. And it's a different calculation for leaders than actually then agreeing to settle the conflict. And so we have to think about those two things differently. If we say, what do we have to give a leader to get him to the table? Then there's a secondary step of what we actually have to give to get them to conclude the war. And that's why some wars continue on for years after both sides have, at least to themselves, decided they want to stop fighting. They have a sense of where the war is going to go. You can look at this in many examples of U.S. history, whether it's the Korean War or Vietnam War. The continuation of fighting didn't get the United States to a better settlement years later than they would have had years before. It was really the obstacle of even starting those talks to begin with that prolonged those conflicts.
Do you have historical examples where the goals of the two parties in a conflict are mutually exclusive? Like, say, Russia saying this part of Ukraine is actually part of Russia or an independent republic, and Ukraine saying no, parts of Ukraine are Ukraine. Both of those things can't be true at the same time. How do you get past that?
Right. So there's a lot of research on certain goods we call in political science being indivisible. So negotiations and being able to negotiate an end to the war assumes that what you're negotiating over can be divided between two sides. Now, technically, you know, territory can all be divided, right? You can decide this part of territory is one country, this part is another. But in some cases, in the minds of individuals, there's this social construction that you have to have all or nothing. And this is just an additional obstacle to wars coming to an end, but it's actually very rare. There's a lot of incentives for leaders to say, you know, it's all or nothing to demonstrate that they have the willingness to keep fighting. They have the willingness to absorb costs to get more at the negotiating table. But it's rarely the case in practice that, you know, what is up for negotiation that states are unwilling to take, you know, only part of the pie instead of all of the pie.
You mentioned the possible mediating role of China, and I know that's a focus of a lot of your work, China's strategic place in the world. From where you're sitting, what is China's interest in this conflict?
So China's main interest is, you know, it reminds me of my kids playing hide and seek, in which they think that if they cover their faces, I can't see them. That's like a large part of what China's strategy is. It's just trying to take the focus off of themselves because they largely want to be neutral and out of it as much as humanly possible. Even with the mediation efforts, it seems very risky to put their necks out on the line to try to mediate something as long as it looks like neither side is particularly interested in negotiating. So my view is if the Chinese agree to mediate, it's because the Russians have told them, okay, if you do this, we will be willing to end the war. So China's mediation in and of itself will be a very useful signal. But the point is that China, and what I'll be talking about at the forum next week is a book I'm working on right now, how China competes against the United States and how they've built so much power in the past 25 years. And one of the main things they do is they do things very differently than the United States, including avoiding any foreign military interventions, which they see as costly and not very efficient and effective at achieving your goals. So I think the bottom line is that China doesn't want countries to even think about China when we're talking about this conflict. But unfortunately, they had a few missteps. And so here we are saying, you know, what is China's role and why can't China do more to help?
Briefly, as we wrap up, Oriana, what should people be watching for if they see headlines about maybe early tentative stages of talks between Ukraine and Russia? What should we be skeptical about? What should make us hopeful?
Well, the first thing, you should be skeptical if you see some of these preconditions, the "I'm willing to talk if" type of language. This actually suggests that that country is not willing to talk at all. They're just trying to win some reputational points saying, you know, I'm willing to do this if you sacrifice everything on your part. So that should make you skeptical. I think, as I mentioned before, if the Chinese agree to mediate, it means that the Russians are on board with bringing this war to an end. That would be something that would be a very positive in that direction.
Oriana, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Oriana Schuyler Mastro is a center fellow at Stanford University, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, author of the book, The Costs of Conversation, about peace negotiations during wartime. Again, she'll be in Madison next Wednesday for the UW La Follette School's Forum on American Power, Prosperity, and Democracy. That's free and open to the public. You can find a link to more info at WPR.org/Central Time.